You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in Archaeology Podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome, everybody, to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 128, 128. Can you imagine? We're going to be here with Katie Olson, who lives in Ridgecrest and has been working closely with me as a research associate, both with the California Rock Art Foundation and also with one of a very important monograph I've been working on for the last 4 years. Katie, are you there?
I'm here.
Perfect. So, Katie, the way we kick this off usually is I ask the million-dollar question. Tell me about your background and why you might be interested in indigenous heritage, cultural resources and values, and perhaps the study of Native art.
Yeah, of course. So I was introduced formally to art history in high school. It was something that I really enjoyed. So I kept learning, you know, through college and stuff, taking courses. But my villain origin story really begins the first time I went to Fossil Falls. It's an alien landscape there, the way that the basalt flows were carved by that ancient river, and I just was amazed, and I wanted to know more. And so I read as much as I possibly could about it, but I really didn't have a good direction for, you know, what I was supposed to be researching to learn about this. And that led me to the Rock Art Podcast, which then led me to the California Rock Art Foundation, and it has been a great source for all of these different topics that I've gotten to read about and explore. And it's just been an amazing experience.
So it's been an interesting adventure and journey since then. So for those that don't know much about Fossil Falls, could you paint us a word picture of maybe where it's located and what's there?
Sure. It is located probably about 20 minutes outside of Ridgecrest. As you're approaching it from the highway, you'll see this, you know, really large red cinder cone that's left over from volcanic activity. And then as you drive up to where the trail starts, you see these basalt flows that just, they go on for miles. And you walk up the trail a little bit, and once you get there, to the left is an old sort of riverbed that is just littered with obsidian, and then to your right are the falls, and the basalt has been carved in a way to where there's these giant cylinder holes in just all of these different shapes. It's really cool. It's like being on an alien planet. And then the falls lead down into a canyon that's more basalt, and it's just, I didn't realize that I was living so close to this huge resource of, you know, cultural knowledge and resource. It's just, it's a really stunning place. And I've been back many, many times. And, you know, each time you go there, you find something new. And it's just a really beautiful place.
So Fossil Falls is just north of Little Lake. It's on the eastern skirt of the Sierra Nevadas in Inyo County. It's on the very edge of the southwestern Great Basin. And it's an area that's owned and managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And it's considered to be a tourist stop that people see. It turns out that many years ago, back about 1977, I was given an opportunity to do an internship with the Bureau of Land Management out of Bakersfield when I was a graduate student at UC Davis in Northern California. And so I jumped at the chance, and I lived in Bakersfield. And for about a month's time, or several months actually, I began to assess inventory and try to understand what was going on at this place called Fossil Falls. So Fossil Falls is the remnant of a waterfall where the ancient Pleistocene Owens River cut a gorge within the basalt flow of the Coso Range. And what Katie was alluding to was the chutes and channeling of the fast-moving waters of the Owens River as they cut through the basalt and, in essence, developed this Swiss cheese effect of holes and chutes and particular remarkable sculptural elements right there within the channel. Now, besides the geological configuration of that remarkable landscape, this was a amazing magnet for prehistoric Aboriginal activity for a variety of reasons. One is because, of course, during the Pleistocene, there was a river there, and not far away was Little Lake, which is just below it. And so it was a place of tremendous cultural activity for about the last, I would say, 10,000 years. Just north of Fossil Falls is a playa, which existed during the what they call the Western Pluvial Lakes tradition for about 8,000 to 12,000 years ago. It probably had a marsh-like effect and was a modest little lake. And so there was a associated cultural activity there. Besides that, at Fossil Falls itself, there are milling slicks and other activities showing that this was a village site that occupation took place. And as one walks around the channels, the ancient Pleistocene River channel, it's one continuous archaeological site for this whole area that probably takes in, I don't know, the better part of a square mile, I would say. And there's open-air campsites and milling and rock shelters and every other possible avenue of archaeological sites. Sort of adding to the drama, we're literally only a few miles away from the remarkable obsidian quarries that exist on the base of China Lake, with an endless array, an endless abundance of Coso volcanic glass. So how's that for a story, Katie?
It was much more eloquent than I had put it.
Well, I've had a long time to think about this. I just looked back on my 1976 monograph they published, which became my master's thesis. And it was rather simple and rather, if you could use the word primitive at the time, I was, you know, kind of a bit of a baby archaeologist by comparison. And I think I was probably overwhelmed by the array of materials they were asking me to try to get a handle on and do something about. They were doing something called a cultural resource management plan, and they wanted me to do one for this area. And they also wanted me to place this area of Fossil Falls on the National Register of Historic Places. This was all part of my assignment. So quite a daunting task for a single individual. Would you agree?
Yes, there's so much there.
So what's down in the canyon? I have rarely, if ever, even been down inside at the base of that falls. Have you?
I have. So me and my friend walked along the side of the waterfall and found a place where we could do a couple of controlled falls into the bottom of the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked all the way, probably a mile up one side and then a mile down, and I could not find anything. But that was my very first place there, you know, and I was relatively new to what I was looking for, and I just didn't know where to look. But there have been other times where I have climbed down into the falls itself, and there is a particular, you know, circular chute that goes all the way up. And when you climb inside of it, the walls of it have different images on it. There's a bighorn sheep, there's a snake, there's a couple other things that don't come to mind immediately. But that was the first time that I had found a petroglyph in Fossil Falls specifically. But it's nothing compared to what's down the way in Little Lake.
So what you found when you were looking there has been researched by others or alluded to in a PhD dissertation. That's a chute, a swirling hole that runs from both, you know, it's exposed at the bottom and exposed at the top and has what's called archaeoacoustic properties. So if you're inside that chute, you can sort of get inside with your whole body and it kind of echoes, it's echophonic. And so that's rather interesting, and I've learned that over the years from others going there. I spent about a month wandering around in there back in the 1970s before I wrote that plan. And I was surprised at how few rock art images I was really able to discern or find or discover in that area. But yet again, the more that I've gone back, and the more that people tell me about, I begin to discover some other things. One of the other elements that I discovered thanks to, I don't know how this happened, but I was looking around right there within the falls itself, right there at the center lip where it daylights to the, you know, the ground itself. And there right below in one of the flutes, totally protected, is a perfect otlatl symbol, one of the circular orbs that are bisected by a line. And it's rather large and rather pristine and very well preserved. And then, of course, off to the right, we see, I think it's four different, rather simple, bighorn sheep that exist within one of those chutes. And we've got that symbol as well. Have you seen the rather elaborate panel that exists if you cut across and look in the river channel and go cross country from the falls sort of back into that maze area up there on the flats, or no?
I haven't.
So there's an elaborate, one of the only elaborate images that I've seen there. And I think we call it the Five Bighorn Rock Shelter because it's right there in the channel. And there on this pyramidal-shaped boulder is something that Campbell Grant called a medicine bag. And then out of the side of the medicine bag looks like there's an otlatl or spear perking out. And then there's several bighorn sheep ascending, looking like they're ascending to the sky. And in the back, you can see the Sierra Nevadas, the majestic Sierra Nevadas in the back. And then a couple more of the bighorn sheep below. It's rather impressive. and it's surprisingly ornate. And that's the most elaborate glyph that I've seen in that entire area. I guess let's continue this discussion on the flip-flop. Well, welcome back, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we're here with Katie Olson, a rock art enthusiast, background in art history, and we're going to talk about her journey with the study of rock art and California Rock Art Foundation and the work we're doing together. So, Katie, how does art history interfinger with your interest in kind of Native American heritage and rock art, etc.? What does that provide for you in terms of perspective or perhaps context?
I believe that art is sort of, you know, this truly universal experience. There are infinite expressions and mediums, but we see these repeating images, you know, across the globe, one of the most prolific being the human form. And I just find it fascinating how throughout art history, we can find context clues about what these people, these ancient people, were trying to convey in this, in these rock art
images. Yeah. Can you give me an example maybe of one of those images that you feel sort of is transcultural and goes across time or gives you some sort of an insight into the significance, meaning, or symbolism of some sort of an image?
Yes. So the earliest rock art in Europe is an engraving of a vulva. It's 37,000 years old. And the vulva, the female genitals or the female in general, it seems to be something that is repeated, you know, everywhere. And I just find it fascinating that even though, you know, these cultures are separated by continents and time, that, you know, we keep bringing up these same subjects about the human form and about the female form too.
So why was the female form such a dominant expression? Why was it such a mnemonic, a sort of memory device? Or what are they trying to communicate by sort of fashioning some images of the female form or female genitals? Does it have to do with fertility? Does it have to do with longevity or revitalization or life and energy? What do you think it has to do with? Just intuition, just kind of asking you out of your gut what you think that was trying to tell us.
I think they were trying to convey the regenerative capabilities of women and their ability to give birth and bring new life into the world was paramount to their survival. You know, you need children to help you, to help take care of you when you're older, or to help you hunt and take care of your family. And there seems to be a cosmology focused on that cycle that begins and is centered around women's capability to make new life.
And I think you're bang on with that. I think that you see that extensively in the rock art that's in Eastern California. And our work has been associated with kind of beginning to deal with that particular issue, hasn't it?
Yeah. You know, we're sort of reevaluating the sexual classifications of the Coso anthropomorphs, you know, being able to look at them in a new sort of, you know, way.
With new eyes.
Yeah. It's a new chapter for rock art theory.
Why do you think that perhaps some of our former colleagues and researchers, when they were examining Coso rock art beginning in 1968, I would say, or even earlier, may not have seen or recognized the significance of the feminine form amongst these animal human figures?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that these archaeologists were predominantly male. And so they don't have as intimate of a view on things like childbirth or, you know, menstruation, all of these different parts of being a woman. I feel like they just didn't have the insight into that to recognize what they were seeing as, you know, female oriented.
Do you think that a female perspective, a womanly perspective, is much more sensitive to these attributes and they become much more visual and significant and are easily attributed to perhaps the same mindset that was being used to fashion these images? Would it matter?
I think it absolutely does.
Tell me a bit about that. Why is that?
A lot of these, you know, images that have been looked over in past research are things that I have drawn from my experience as a woman. For example, there's, you know, quite a few anthropomorphs that have these three lines of where the genitals would be. And
it's obvious to you what those mean, correct?
Yes. So
what do you think those imply? Because when I've looked in the literature, I just don't see the denotation, the connotation, the identification of that kind of symbology as an association of the feminine form.
I have two children. The way that they determine sex in an ultrasound for a girl is they look for these three lines. And those three lines right next to each other is how they determine, you know, if it's a girl. If it's a boy, it's one line and it's got two shorter lines on either side of it. I think this is a visual shorthand for the female genitals. In a lot of cases, when it's just the lines, it's the negative space is being utilized to, you know, show that there's something there.
What's amazing is using exactly the same vernacular, the same linguistic clues, the words that I've used in my research when I'm talking about these attributes on rock art, visual shorthand. And that is certainly what others have found who are really insiders who have delved into the mysteries of indigenous cosmology, of Native American thought and religious precepts and the cognitive map of the universe, the worldview of Native people. That is not such an easy thing to pierce. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, past research has, you know, just taken such a different stance around these images. But I've just been really fortunate to be a part of that conversation with you. And it's the connotations for this is just so far spread, and we're just barely touching the surface of it. It's fascinating.
So what the previous literature told us was that these both decorated and solid-bodied animal-human figures were exclusively male, were men, and not women. And it became clear to me and to a woman who completed her dissertation on this subject within the COSOS that that appeared to be incorrect, that as we look closer and closer at these images and examine them in fine detail with a much larger inventory, that something different was going on. I think what really was revolutionary was when Caroline Maddock published her book on COSO pattern-bodied anthropomorphs and sketched 450 individual sketches of these figures all throughout the COSOs. And she was a little tongue-in-cheek, and she wasn't explicit. She was rather tongue-in-cheek and rather, how would you put this, implying. She said, well, my study is on the feminine basis for these COSO pattern-bodied anthropomorphs, which was in some ways shocking, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, she kind of opened up the space for us to re-explore, you know, these themes in the COSO rock art pertaining to women. And there's just so much there that I see now and think, you know, how did somebody look at this and not see, you know, someone giving birth or see the feminine behind these different pieces of art?
What do you see as the strongest trend or the strongest visual clue that these are feminine?
Outside of, I mean, first and foremost is just the genitals, the female genitals, the explicit female genitals. But outside of that, there's, these mid-birth postures where, you know, between the legs of the anthropomorph is, you know, something that looks like afterbirth. And then up to one side of them will be a smaller figure of a baby. And that will have an umbilical cord trailing off of it. And there's an example in Sheep Canyon of this mid-birth posture with a anthropomorph that has a little tiny bighorn sheep between their legs.
This is sort of a little mini picture of sort of the genealogy of the people, right? The mother and the child, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So they're showing the comparison between the human side and the animal side. And I've seen that replicated in quite a number of places in the Cosos. What about those hair whorls and the menstruation that's shown?
So the images that I've been studying are in the Caroline Maddock volume. And a lot of times you will see these anthropomorphs that have, you know, this... You put it best was a blood tether or something like that.
Yeah, it's a tendril that is a meandering thread. How's that?
Yeah, and it's not like a straight line usually.
No.
Sometimes there's a puddle. Yeah, sometimes there's a puddle at the end of them. But yeah, this meandering sort of line. And in those images, a lot of the times the anthropomorphs have these hair whorls, these sort of circular figures on either side of their head, which is heavily associated with, is it the Hopi elk?
It's a coming of age attribute. The hair amongst the Hopi and the Pueblo are depicted that way because it's called the squash blossom or the butterfly hairdo. It has to do, it's a symbol of transformation, transmogrification, coming of age. It's the time when women are finally amenable to reproduction. It's an opening up of sort of the life form. It's a benchmark in their lives where they become women and transforming their lives and wearing this hairdo. It's a double bun on the right and left side. And one of the things I learned, which shocked me, I didn't know that, was that one of the things they're trying to show is what's called a quinsunk. And that's a 5-in-1 kind of a cross. The face is the center, and the four modules are the four other sides of the cross. It's like a human encircled cross, which has the meaning of resurrection and transformation. It has the meaning of a connection with the tether of the divine, the creator in the center of that cross. Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the quinsunk. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, quinsunk, yes.
The quinsunk,
yeah.
It's one of those images that you also see repeated, you know, over and over again in different cultures and different places. You know, there seems to be a lot of widespread meaning associated with that image.
And that symbol, of course. Let's take a break here. See you on the flip-flop, gang, and we'll conclude with the third segment. Welcome back to the final segment in our three-part journey with Katie Olson. Learning about the interpagination, the interfingering of art history, the feminine elements, and that theme that seems to be intertwined in Koso rock art, the early archaic Koso rock art. Katie, I know this is pushing the envelope a little bit, but it seems to me that these figures are perhaps less shamanistic and more perhaps supramundane beings, goddesses of sort of protection and survival and love and courage and all of that and much more. Do you get that flavor, or is this a misreading of the rock art record?
No, I definitely agree. These images appear to be like a visual prayer, an expression of the, you know, reverence and importance of the, you know, female aspect of the life cycle and their cosmology.
And why would they choose a feminine being to do that?
Well,
because they're a mother.
Yes, because they're a mother. Sorry,
they're a Alex. Mother. Because, yes. Because sometimes it's easier to go to mom than to dad, right?
Right. And, you know, just in the regenerative capabilities and how that ties to their cosmology and the animal master that, you know, brings forth the animals from the essential animal underworld and starts life anew. Just the same as how, you know, a woman brings new life into the world.
I've tried to talk a little bit about a creation story amongst the Huichol and the Aztecs and somewhat of the Hopi. And it seems like these images are intertwined with snakes and other things, and also with celestial beings and the sun and the moon and the sky and the heavens. What's that all about?
Oh, man. There's a lot there.
Yeah.
You know, not every, you know, lunar deity that you come across is female, but, you know, females are highly associated with lunar deities, you know, especially considering that their menstrual cycle, you know, it's the same as the cycles of the moon. And you see a lot of representation of that in these anthropomorphs. There's these bodies that are filled with these dots. And as you count up the dots, you realize that it's essentially a menstrual calendar. And, you know, the fact that they put so much effort into making this art, and so many of these pieces of art that express that sort of lunar calendar, it, to me, it seems like they, you know, had a very deep connection with this cycle of, you know, a woman's life and its association to birth, death, and that.
And the ability to reproduce. One of the things I had not done before, I was like the first to sort of, it gives me the tingles, the Koso glow to think back to this. The thing that was the key in the lock that allowed me to begin to understand Koso rock art was my 4-year odyssey in doing the book on the Handbook of the Kawaiisu, because they forced me to read the sacred narratives, the mythology. And as I read again and again and again about the animal master, animal mistress, I began to understand some analogies, some connectivities between what the Koso ancestral imagery could mean. One of the things that was that connection was they kept talking about quail, quail and quail and quail, that this particular deity, this supramundane being, wore a quail shawl or a quail skirt. And in the analogous, they would open up a bag, and he was the father or the mother of an infinite amount of quail. And I kept going, why quail? Why quail? Why quail? Well, what it turns out was sort of quail is sort of it's a metaphor, isn't it, for tremendous reproductive fertility. And the number of babies that they produce is unbelievable. Plus, these quail themselves are associated with areas that are full of life, that are wet and moist, etc. And so there's something going on there as well that seemed to bring it about to show me that there's something here that needs to have a connection. Plus, in terms of the lunar element, on that same rock, the famous rock that I've talked about in several articles that is a manifestation of this broad and robust sacred narrative and oral history on Yahwera and the supernatural gamekeeper, is a lunar count. It's a lunar count of the 25 to 28 days of the month that the moon is available. And I've talked, and I didn't know anything about this until I talked to Ed Krupp, who told me, well, that's a lunar count, Alan. That's what's going on there. And that's a representation of the moon. And then when I went in to look at the language of the Kauai Sioux, I found out that they have words in their native language for all the different kind of parts of the moon, from the beginning moon to the waning moon to the middle moon to the end moon. And so I said, wow, the moon obviously was a central and important part of their cosmology, as well as the sun. So the sun itself was important because of the winter solstice and the summer solstice. And I only learned about that because as I began to understand more and more and more, I experienced a rock art site there in the far Southern Sierras that served as a calendar and had a solstitial alignment. So when you're there during the winter solstice sunrise, you get to see the sun sit right at the peak of the highest peak in the far Southern Sierras. And it sits there and does not move for about 30 seconds. And I also began to understand how the Hopi and other of these indigenous cultures were sun and sky watchers because they knew that when that sun came to that winter solstice sunrise, it would stay in the heavens for several days and then continue its journey back the other way. But it was a period of time when it was a standstill, and that was the time when they had their winter solstice or sun ceremony, or also called the fire ceremony, where it was very important to reinaugurate the cycle and bring back the sun. Does that make any sense, Katie?
Yeah, so that, you know, that sounds really similar to a lot of things that I've read about the Mesoamerican, you know, rebirth of the sun, sort of reigniting the sun in their cosmology and their stories.
Exactly. So although this may seem a bit fanciful, there seems to be a very remote and ancient connection between what could be called the early Uto-Aztecan, the archaic Uto-Aztecan expression of, let's say, a creation narrative that appears to be replicated amongst the Huichol and the high cultures of the Nahua and is shown on the imagery in the Cosos. And that is shocking. And it's, we're talking about something that's, you know, 1,000 miles away or even further. And it's rather controversial, but yet again, it seems rather transparent that there was an analog, some sort of a parallel belief about this reinauguration of the sun and the importance of the sun cycle and the seasonality and the circuitous nature of the seasons. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. What also comes to mind is the, you know, how many images in the Cosos have, you know, either snake patterns or they're holding snakes and then they'll have a ceremonial wand in the other hand. And just how, could you talk a little bit about how the snakes sort of tie into that Mesoamerican cosmology? Because I remember we were speaking and there's just some really amazing things there.
Well, it's endless. We wrote a 70,000 word book about the snake and its significance from its inception all the way to the high cultures of Mexico. So there seems to be, you know, this obsession with the snake, which surprised the heck out of me. I found it very difficult to understand why would a snake, which is considered in Christian theology, the absolute negative and the absolute, you know, devilish element, how could that have to do with a positive realm of life and regeneration and all the other elements that would seem to be packaged by these native people? But as I began to try to, you know, deconstruct it and understand it, it became rather transparent what we're looking at. You know, as the snake wanders around the surface of the ground, it also goes in the ground. So it's a liminal creature. It loses its skin. It goes through a,
you know, a defoliation. And so it appears to be almost like a revitalistic or regenerative element. It's also, snakes come out when it rains. So they're bringers of rain. And if they're bringers of rain and they also have this circuitous movement, it looks like they're much about water. And so when the native people looked at the sky, they saw the sky snake and the Virga rain. And so they saw the snake as a bringer of rain. And rain, of course, in the desert was an absolute critical regenerative factor. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I found it fascinating that so many of these female figures are pictured with snakes.
Yeah. And they're holding snakes in both hands, or they're associated with a snake symbology. And one of the things we were able to do, which also shocked me, and I was learned this from one of my colleagues, I didn't get this, that the words they have for certain baskets mean rattlesnake and gopher snake. And that's what those symbols are. Those representational designs are significant, and they have meaning to the native people in their own language. And so the rattlesnake and the rattlesnake baskets and the rattlesnake symbolism meant much, much more to them in a positive mode, in a regenerative mode, in an inspirational or how would you put it, almost a resurrection or a rebirth mode, a transformational mode than what we might think of. So it had a very strong positive, but also the negative mode, because it's a killer. It's an animal that can kill you if it bites you and can kill you dead. And this binary opposition between life and death is something that's also very characteristic of the Uto-Aztecan realm of thought. I'm sure you're aware of that or see that in your art history kinds of understanding. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. What comes to mind is that specific, and you've told me the name of this statue probably 20 times, and I still can't remember it.
It's the Coatlicue statue.
I like how you know what I'm talking about, because I've asked so many times.
Well, it's the goddess of the moon. And, you know, they were digging the subway in downtown Mexico, and they found this 25-ton statue. 25 tons, right?
It is.
And it's a woman. It has breasts. It's also got, you know, a cord around its waist. It's pregnant, and it's birthing a snake, and it's built with snakes. And the funny thing is that there's an analog in the Kosos. One of our decorated animal humans has a snake coming out of its genitals, and it could be either a snake or also a, you know, some of the that connecting tether as you birth a baby, right?
Right.
So
that's my favorite example out of all of this. I love, one day I'll remember the name of the statue, but it's my favorite.
Well, I found that dealing with the cosmological realm and understanding the Mexican culture and opening up my mind to all this literature on Mesoamerica was very, very daunting. It's enormous. And to even try to begin to understand the voluminous nature of their cosmology and the many, many years and many individuals that have attempted to do so is rather impressive. Would you agree?
Yes.
So anyways, is there anything you want to tell people as an exit or as a commemorative sign to your experiences with rock art and art history as sort of a communique to the listenership?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think when it comes to analyzing these images, what we tend to do is first go to the most obvious. And I would just encourage people to, take another look, maybe take a step back, try to think about things in a different perspective, and you'll be surprised at, you might find something new.
Fantastic. Thank you, gang, for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rock Art Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.